Well, we know what it's like to feel worried and helpless about the state of our world.
But we're finding comfort and inspiration from people tackling winner-take-all economics and other root causes of climate change, inequity, and global unrest.
Join us on the road from wasteland to wonderland. This is Pot of Gold.
In this episode, we have the privilege of speaking with Anna Cohen and John Zinniotis, leaders of the two-year Flow Research Project, conducted in partnership with the University of Cape Town African Climate and Development Initiative.
The project took place in two South African towns. The aim of the project was to build out the individual as well as community capacities of these towns to face the challenges of climate change, resource depletion, and inequality. Exactly what we are about on the Pot of Gold podcast.
In order to achieve this goal, Flow engaged a cohort of out-of-work, out-of-school local youth called Flow Ambassadors, who were responsible for creating asset maps of their communities, documenting their stories through short film, engaging with the local government, and introducing two new community currencies to bolster the local economy. We're very excited to hear more about this project from Anna and John.
Can you maybe start to introducing yourself?
So I'm Anna Cowan, from Cape Town, South Africa, and I'm trained as an architect and an urbanist, and I'm also an educator and a facilitator. And we're here because of the work that we've done in our Flow project over the last few years.
Okay, John, what about you?
My name is John Zinniotis. I'm from Cape Town, South Africa. And I'm trained as an electrical engineer, but have spent most of my life in the startup world, particularly the internet startup world, and more recently, spent about 8 years in the sustainability space with Anna, and at the moment really interested in the money space. So anything related to money, complementary currencies, cryptocurrencies. I'm fascinated with how the conversation is changing as the big cryptocurrencies are coming into the world.
Well, Anna, could you expand a little bit about what Flow is and how it started?
Sure. Flow's kind of had a long history, really, a long genesis story. So in my practice as an architect, my work has really been around participatory design. And I've always believed that experts don't have all the solutions, that the best buildings, the best cities are ones that are co-created. So my work has always been an inquiry into how to do that better. Like, how do we actually work in a way where everybody feels they're a designer? That it's not just something out there. How can we create cultures where every single human being genuinely feels that? It's not just a kind of nice idea. And when I was doing my master's, I did a master's in sustainable urbanism in the early 2000s. I was traveling in Ethiopia, and I came across this project in Addis Ababa, which was a social housing project. And the way that they did need assessments of who got to get the first house mm-hmm. in these slums was young women from the community, young girls, really, 13-year-olds. They were the ones who did the needs assessments, and they wore these yellow bibs, and they were called the yellow girls. And they would go around with their clipboards and do interviews, and they were from that community. And the woman who ran this project was called the Integral Holistic Approach, the name of the project, which I thought was kind of cool. She was a nurse, not an urban practitioner. She was a nurse. And I loved that because she didn't come from a traditional kind of urban background. Mm-hmm. And the story was that they'd tried these need assessments with other people, with students. And the students didn't engender trust. So what would happen is that the community members would lie mm-hmm. about their needs and try and get to the top of the list. But when it was young girls from the community, they told the truth.
That's so
and I found it so interesting. It made me really, really think about participatory development. It was one of those real Damascus moments. And since then, which is 2002, I've been kind of cooking up this idea around youth mapping their own communities as a way to become creators of their own communities. That the kind of act of mapping is a creative act, and the artifacts that are produced are community commons, and they're alive, and they could serve as the foundation for as planning tools, really. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of idea was I'd been sort of seeding since then. And it was only in 2012 that an opportunity came along to actually ground it in practice. And that was an integrated sustainable development plan that I was a part of a team of. And so, and John was very involved in this. We were basically given the space in this project to identify young people from this community. And it was Kokstad, which is one of these towns that we landed up working in. And spent this amazing year with young people from this community where they did this, where they began to map. And we called it one of the processes, the seeds of sustainability. So what we asked them to do was to make little movies around the seeds of the future, to find little stories like a worm farm, or there was a wetlands restoration project. So these small little projects are already happening, but if you begin to link them up, begin to form a kind of matrix that one can actually do sustainable development from. And so that was the kind of the seed of the one side of Flow.
What did the map look like at the end of the year? What did you have?
So the one map that we did, the Seeds of Sustainability map, was quite literally a Google map with these different stories kind of embedded into it.
How large is the community?
About 40,000 people.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that was this the one seed was kind of really my deep kind of commitment and passion to this way of doing development. And John had been exploring the kind of money space, and we were sort of beginning to see how it could come together. And then 2 years later, this opportunity came with some funding and an amazing team of collaborators. And we sort of saw a way to weave these two different threads together.
So how did you weave them together?
I'm gonna lob it over to you for a bit, John.
So the we basically saw this methodology as an opportunity to aid a sort of to co-design a community currency intervention, and the community currencies was part of a much broader strategy, and that was to assist these communities in developing resilient strategies in different ways. You know, we saw a link between the startup capital that was required for a lot of these resilient businesses, which often there wasn't money for social or environmental opportunities. And we said, what if we could provide a way where there would be a flow of community currencies, so currencies that emerges from the assets and the value that's in the community, to co-fund together with a national currencies, fiat money, that provided the sort of the goods or the things that had to be imported, and that those provided the foundation. So we actually came up with a metaphor where if you're trying to grow something, the one thing you have to have is fertile ground. So the strategy was is to develop the skills of these young Flow ambassadors. So working with young people from the community, teaching them how to, supporting them to look at their community in a new way by making movies with mobile phones and doing research and really inquiring into what works in the community from an appreciative inquiry. And that's developing the fertile ground. And then these seeds of sustainability become in order for the seeds to grow, you need water. And we saw the community currency as the water that was required to water the seeds in the fertile ground in order to for these things to take root.
Impressive.
So what happens?
So we started off by selecting the youth. Mm-hmm. You know, okay. Once we'd gathered our project team, and the project team was built from years of relationships of people that we had, you know, worked with over years and really wanted to work together with quite diverse skills. So okay. There was an application process, mm-hmm. and then they needed to submit a digital application,
okay.
because that was a kind of the first hurdle, mm-hmm. was to see if they could even send an email.
Okay.
I mean, we're dealing with unbelievable levels of poor education and not having good access to resources. Mm-hmm. So there were a few criteria. One was being able to submit it digitally, and one was having some kind of interest in community issues. I'm trying to remember.
And out, I mean, so the criteria was out of work. So the youth, so if you were employed, you weren't considered, and out of school. So there needed to be some, so, you know, you finished your secondary education, finished your schooling, and you were in a gap year, or you were just kind of.
So we're talking about 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds.
18-year-olds all the way up to
35.
35.
So, okay. So in South Africa, the kind of official definition of youth is that broad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's actually pretty realistic, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. We only grow up when we may be 40.
Yeah, maybe. You have no life patterns until you're 35. I'm not an adult.
Well, we spent quite a lot of time in the first 3 months articulating a theory of change. And so the essence of that theory of change was that there are three aspects that we believe are foundational to a resilient community. The one is deepening connection to our life support systems, like really beginning to understand in the deepest way what supports us. You know, food, water, social networks, culture,
energy,
really, really reconnecting people. Mm-hmm. You know, because most people don't even, you know, we kind of switch that awareness off. So that was the one, was to actually to measure, you know, the change of awareness in people's connection to what supports life.
And beyond just the team, beyond just the immediate Flow ambassadors, so including the community that we were working with.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the other two were increased social cohesion, mm-hmm. and autonomy. Individual autonomy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, something that one sees as a kind of legacy of apartheid is how individual autonomy was crushed. I mean, in the township schools, there were no art facilities. That was deliberate.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, there was
a real suppression of human creativity.
That's right.
And intentional.
Yeah, no. Intentional.
Yeah. So just to honor people as full creative beings, for almost every single one of those young people, it was a new experience. And they weren't being, I mean, they most of them were not born into apartheid, but the legacies are still very strong.
Yes.
Just as an example of the young people in Bagrifi, their greatest aspiration, not from the project, but just in life, was either to get a job at the local municipality to join the HR department in the local municipality, or to go and work for a cement company, which was one of the bigger companies that were in that region. So that was it. That was their worldview. That was, once they had done that, they had made it. Mm-hmm. And they had no aspirations beyond that.
So the social cohesion thing was also really important. It was, if we just achieved a little bit of an improvement in each of those three spheres, for us that was success. So just to kind of give a sense of what it was like for them, they were selected within, I think, 24 hours of the interviews. I think the adverts went out about a month before. If we had the luxury of time, we would give it at least 3 months to find good people, the right people. And then they dived into this very intense curriculum that was a combination of this life support system analysis. So they looked at how rubbish works, you know, how does recycling work, They looked at where energy comes from, where water comes from. And so they did quite a lot of that, watched lots of movies. Mm-hmm. You know, we exposed them to loads of movies from all around the world. Did lots of kind of group building exercises. And then they started mapping the economic story of the town.
And one of the key modules was learning about money, sort of. So, mm-hmm. so really kind of doing a deep dive. And it was, I mean, that was came completely out of the blue for them. And it was very empowering for them because they, you know, they in the community meetings, which we'll come to, they were empowered, they felt empowered because they had a grasp of these, of this topic of money, which is like magic. I mean, for everybody, not just, you know, for people that maybe come from underprivileged, situations. So yeah, the conversation with money and then, one of the things that they had to learn because we had the partnership with the university is we needed to do a research, and there was this process where we had to do control interviews in order to see what are the changes, you know, before and after, in order so that the economics department at the university could do the research. And part of the process was them learning how to ask. So first of all, sort of knocking on doors, explaining where they come from, asking these questions, which is, you know, which might seem straightforward, but it's like, again, it's just such a powerful life experience for them to have. And that took quite a bit of time, and that required a lot of organization. So it's the project organization in order to, you know, get through, I think we gave them
200 tasks, surveys.
200 surveys. So to identify 200 businesses, both sort of what we said is the visible and invisible businesses. So the visible businesses are those that have signs and one can find in a Yellow Pages.
Or just walking
down the street.
Yeah.
The invisible businesses were the ones that were the most interesting for our community currency project. And the way that we got them to start thinking about what these businesses were was asking the question, if there was a wedding in town, who would make the dress? Who would do the catering? Where would you hire the tent from? Who would do the music? Who would do the disco? So these were all, creches, hairdressers that worked from home. So all these little businesses were dotted around the town and were invisible, even though people knew about them. Mm-hmm. So that was part of the process of them identifying, mapping where these businesses were, and then doing the survey in preparation for the sort of following launch of the currency. And the key thing, one of the key things was also to then show how the local government operated and played a role in making the community work.
One of the things they also did was they made movies of municipal services. So they'd do a project of a sewer works or the water filtration plant or the one of the substations for energy. And so most of them had never seen these places or the landfill site. So they'd make these little movies and they would get shown at these council, these kind of big public meetings. And so that was really fruitful, that kind of expression and engagement in kind of in civil life was great.
It sounds like you worked a lot with media, like learning through documentation of an observation as opposed to doing a report or something.
Yeah.
So what was intentional is so we can speak theoretically about these systems, so the water system, the energy system, the recycling waste system, etc. But the way that we made it real for these young people is to get them to make movies so understanding it through the artifact that they created. So like owning it for themselves as opposed to just sitting and writing notes and kind of, okay, I think I understand how the energy system works.
It's amazing. So how did the currency come in?
So the challenge with the currency is because it was such a new idea, we needed to get the conversation going in terms of involving the community. So through a long process, we decided to use a mutual credit design, which essentially built on businesses in the community. So selecting businesses in the community that would lend money to each other through this community currency. And then in a later phase, as this community currency got some value, it would then filter into the rest of the community and start circulating more broadly.
So this is almost a completely separate project than the youth project in terms of implementation.
Although the youth were doing the mapping, so they were learning about life support systems and mapping those, and then they began to map the economic system as the foundation for the currency. So they mapped all these informal businesses, as well as those visible and invisible, and they then we identified people to survey as the baseline for the currency, and they were all potential people who would potentially be network members of this mutual credit system, but they hadn't signed up yet. So it was just a broad sweep of 200 possible network members were surveyed. So they did the surveys.
Okay.
And then at the same time that they were doing, they were also learning how to make these movies. So their subjects were these businesses. So they started doing these 2-minute movies around 30
seconds.
We did two different kinds of movies.
Yeah.
We did one called Loving Local, which were 2-minute stories about kind of local heroes. and then these 30-second advertorials. And it emerged in such a lovely way. I mean, we had no idea we were going to do this at the beginning, that these little advertorials were going to be absolutely key to enrolling members into the mutual credit network.
So first of all, we needed to attract these businesses to even come to the meetings in the first place. So what was the hook? What was the kind of marketing? How do we get people to the meetings? What we would do is so the young people would make these 30-second advertorials. We then say to them that at the next community currency meeting, your advertorial is going to be shown.
That's fantastic.
They would come with,
that was its own currency.
Yeah.
The big insight that sort of Anna noticed is that Anna had spent many, many years sort of having community meetings around sustainability issues, and never in the time that we've had these meetings had there been this engaged conversation
interesting.
So to try and engage people to talk about localization when you're saying it's important to localize your food production, it's important to localize your energy production.
It's abstract.
Just go to sleep.
It's like, whatever. If you start saying, let's talk about money and then let's talk about localization, it's the whole
it's a completely different
room
conversation.
Comes alive.
Yeah.
So the let's talk about money just is you know, and if one can hold that conversation, can be a really profound just in that meeting.
Let's talk about local money.
So it increased the level of engagement even in the conversation.
Yeah, I mean I think that's something to take away for all of us. That just having those conversations.
Yeah.
Is profound.
So why do you think talking about money is so much more engaging?
I think because money is freedom. Money is power. And money is access. And I think money is also not something that people really think about until they do. And then every single time we saw it, people just lit up as they began to understand it was a design.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that so many times.
It's like a fish in the water and you don't realize
it's exactly like that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Like noticing the water.
You're noticing
the water.
I mean, most of us don't even know there's water. So yeah, it's that kind of awareness that we're swimming in water. So I think that there's a lot of richness and potential in that methodology that's applicable in any community.
Mm-hmm. Is it available and free to the
completely?
Yeah.
So basically
completely.
Your dream would be that any practitioner in the world who's interested in the sustainability subject and
absolutely.
Money, strong link to money, sustainability.
Yeah.
Basically, go to the flow.org website, download flowafrica.org website, download the PDF, read through, learn from what you've done, build on your shoulders.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would make
us so happy.
Yeah. So one of the big lessons that I learned as an engineer, and it's interesting, we had this conversation a little bit earlier. As an engineer, you kind of think in terms of solutions to problems. And the big takeaway for me is listening more carefully to the needs that need to be met. In fact, one of the conversations we had today was someone that had been in the space for 25 years, who said that, you know, he learned after many iterations to ask the question, what is needed, and respond to that, mm-hmm. as opposed to come with a sort of pre-designed. So the one thing is listening more carefully. The other thing is also not to directly import designs, and particularly with these money. So the danger with money and complementary currency, and now the sort of the new kid on the blockchain and cryptocurrencies, is that it's seen as the magic bullet that's going to solve everything. Just throw a little bit into the community and boom, there you go, uplifted community. And in our experience, it's probably like the last thing that you need to be in. Mm-hmm. So the design of this, in order to make it sustainable. Mm-hmm. And it's key, and coming back to my first point, it's key to listen to what is needed so that the design responds to those needs. So one of the errors that we made in South Africa, in both the communities, was relying on businesses that in their own right were not strong enough to operate in the normal environment, never mind with the complexities of a community currency laid onto that. So those are my insights.
Really, it's been fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, wonderful.
For me, Flow is one of the most well thought through projects I ever so far have encountered in this world. You know, it's not just, it's actually the complementary currency is not the main thing. I would say here in Flow, they've really thought this through, and I admire the complexity and the interconnectivity of the project. And then very interesting to see how in two very different communities, this, not only took place, but how it came about and how much help and how much, empowerment, I think, it brought to those villages.
Agreed. And it was cool to me that they used youth to implement that system, not a bunch of engineers or economists, but taking local youth who have to deal with the future that's ahead of them and having them really exercise those skills and develop their ability to see the economic forces in play and implement new tools to make that economy stronger and more resilient. Fascinating.
No, it is truly awesome. No, it is truly awesome. I really do think it's truly awesome how Anna and John, how they thought this through and that they are actually offering it to the world. You know, everyone can go to their website. It's flowafrica.org. Download the stuff, download all the documentation. It's so well documented. I love it. I mean, you don't have to read it all. You don't need to read it all in order to understand. Just get the stuff and apply in your own community. As easy as that.
Please keep in mind that these recordings may not be as high quality as they usually are because we're doing them in a time of social distancing. But thank you to Zoom for allowing us to continue making this podcast.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore. Thanks for listening.